Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of June. All things political always on Mondays at 9 o'clock, and we have quite a lineup this morning, actually for both hours of our program. Frank Rich joins us in just a few minutes. He's a marvelous columnist for the New York Times, and will be with us to talk about his column yesterday, One Historic Night, Two Americas. Former White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan, also this hour, on his new book, What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. Our two of this program today on Monday, Richard Engel, who's NBC's News Award-winning Middle East Bureau Chief on his 5 years in Iraq, and his new book, War Journal, My 5 Years in Iraq. You'll be welcome to join us, of course, all 2 hours today, and you can do so by calling 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. Frank Rich is calling in just a couple minutes, so let me give you his bio and just a little bit from his column yesterday, which will spark some thought, I think, and some reaction on your part. Frank Rich is the first op-ed columnist for the New York Times, and the first person I read in the Times on Sunday morning because he's so darn literate. He's been at the paper since 1980 when he was named chief theater critic in 1999. He became the first Times columnist to write a regular double-length column for the op-ed page, and his column, of course, draws from his background as a theater critic and observer of art, entertainment, and politics. He is the author of several books, including most recently The Greatest Story Ever Sold, The Decline and Fall of Truth from 9/11 to Katrina, Ghostlight, a Memoir, Hot Seat, Theater Criticism for the New York Times from 1980 to 1993, and he will be joining us momentarily. Scott McClellan, of course, will join us at 9:30 this morning, and Scott will be talking about why he wrote the book that he wrote. He spends a lot of time on the Iraq War, his initial faith in the values of President Bush, and searching his own soul because he felt that he wasn't telling the entire truth about Valerie Plame, about Wilson, about the war in Iraq. So he'll be a good guest. The number again for you to join us, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050, if you're joining us in Milwaukee. Hello, Frank.
Hi, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm fine, given that it's about 115 degrees in New York, but otherwise I'm fine.
Is it really that hot?
It's not that hot. I'm exaggerating, but it's supposed to be record heat today of close to 100.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we had 9 inches of rain, so
we
could top you, maybe. It hasn't been good. Let's start with yesterday's column. You know, I had the same reaction you did when you talk about neither Clinton nor McCain last Tuesday night had the grace to offer a salute to what had happened on Tuesday night, which was a very, very big event, and as you say, reverberated so powerfully, not only across the country and throughout the world. By being so small and ungenerous, they made him look taller.
Yes, well, I think, you know, look, certainly Hillary Clinton and John McCain are smart enough and I think sensitive enough to appreciate that an African-American getting to be the presumptive nominee of a major political party is a historic day in America. Yet, incredibly, they were both so caught up in their own partisan interests at that moment. In Clinton's case, not wanting to concede defeat, even though she had been defeated, and trying, it seemed also, to sort of rev everyone up for more fundraising. The punchline of her whole speech seemed to be to go to her website, which, if you went to, was all about just giving money. And McCain, incredibly ungracious, he barely acknowledged anything about Obama, and devoted a whole speech to a poor speech, I might add, mm-hmm. to attacking him, even as he appropriated his slogan and everything else. And to me, all this is a symptom of the Washington dysfunction that Obama talks about. Everyone is so dug in to their narrow concerns that they just can't see beyond it, regardless of ideology. One point I made in the column is that just use of the first person
yes.
in those speeches McCain and Clinton both used the first person about 60 times each, whereas Obama did it half as much. And I thought that was kind of telling about the difference in visions between their generation and his.
Right. Well, tell me more about what you meant when you said, Frank, that Obama's vision is inseparable from his identity.
Well, here's a guy who is, I think, by nature, optimistic and cheerful. I don't think it's an act. It's the cliche of hope at one level, but beyond that, it's what he exudes, like it or not. Now, where does that come from? It comes from the fact that he actually does have a slim resume in Washington and has gone very far from a really different itinerant background on his talents, which don't include only speaking, obviously, but you know he wasn't head of the Harvard Law Review, and he wasn't a successful community organizer, and all the rest of it for lack of talent, and also for the fact that he is an African American who's made it close to the top now in American life at a relatively young age. Mm. So why shouldn't he be optimistic about America, and why shouldn't he feel that some of the goodwill and hard work that got him to the top can maybe work for other people in a government that he might be the chief executive of?
Right. It is amazing that he did, or maybe I'm making too much of this, but the fact that he could have gone the direction of making one heck of a lot of money, which a lot of people want to do in this country, and he says this frequently. Instead, he doesn't talk that much about turning it down, the money, but he makes a lot of the fact that he was a community organizer on the south side of Chicago, and maybe because I'm from Chicago, I make a big deal out of that as well. That I think that says a lot about him, that he chose that.
I agree with you. I also, and to return to the point about Chicago, I'm a total fanatic about Chicago. I've spent a lot of time there various ways, although never lived there. I think he's very much a product of Chicago, and that's often forgotten. Part of it is he decided to go there, indeed, turning down clerkships and high-priced law firms. He decided to go work in the streets as a community organizer. He's also a product of Chicago's complicated and often rough politics, and some of it's bruised him a bit, as you know, in the case of one of his contributors who was found guilty past a couple of weeks, and a friend of his. But on the other hand, he developed the sense from Chicago, to me, is the American city, more than New York, more than any city on either coast, and that mix and that negotiation between races and class and so on, and what he had to do as a community organizer is intrinsic to his view of politics. So, by the way, a sharp elbows, as a friend of mine from Chicago often says, you do not get to be the Democratic senator from Illinois coming up to Chicago politics unless you are really tough. It is not for shrinking violets.
Right. The other thing that we noticed early on, we did a broadcast from Dubuque for the Iowa caucus, and just wandering around the streets, Frank, I was amazed how many school teachers from Chicago, people who had been in the legislature with him, just gave up the whole month to walk around the very icy streets of Dubuque to campaign for this guy. He had one, and probably still does, phenomenal organization in place.
Well, he really does, and in a way, that's how he beat Clinton. More than anything else, he decided to do actually what Howard Dean, to much ridicule, had prescribed for the Democratic Party, which is to organize in every state possible, not just concentrate on the big states. So that's why he walloped the Clinton campaign in the caucuses and in unlikely places, at least at the start, like Iowa. And now that organization is in place. I think it also speaks of Chicago, that kind of organization, the Daily Machine, that kind of template in a way, although it's different, obviously, in a number of facets. And also, it expresses something about his use of the Internet and understanding of the culture of the Internet, that it's not just about fundraising or cutesy gimmicks and bells and whistles on a website, but the basic user-friendly aesthetic of the Internet, the bottom-up part of it, the fact that people network socially but also for social welfare goals or political goals, he mined all that and let people come up with their own ideas in local areas, and then let them do it on their own with minimal supervision or oppression from a campaign hierarchy, as opposed to the Clinton campaign, which did everything from the Beltway with high-priced consultants, some of whom didn't even leave their day jobs as, working as, or Mark Penn didn't leave his day
right.
job working as a corporate PR guy.
Right. He was always a bad face for that campaign. I don't know why they held on to him.
Well, here's a question I'm wrestling with and may write about at some point. Why did the Clinton campaign have so many male faces representing it and so few women representing it? I don't mean in terms of the whole campaign, but in terms of what's on network television, cable television. It was very top-heavy, not just with Mark Penn, but obviously with Bill Clinton, Howard Wolfson. I just didn't understand that. Hillary Clinton obviously was her own very good representative, but where were the female surrogates? Why did they have these sort of really kind of coarse guys fronting for the campaign?
Right.
I just don't get it.
Right. Who forgot to shave often, too. I don't know why he forgot to shave so often.
He forgot to shave and also was incredibly arrogant.
Yes, yeah.
And everything you don't like about men, really. One might not like about men. Speaking as a man, I can say that.
Oh, you're such a gracious man, Frank. It's fine. Did she make up for her lack of grace on Tuesday with Saturday's speech?
I thought Saturday's speech was good. I wasn't knocked on my heels by it. Tuesday's speech was, of course, I think a disaster, and she realized that. Look, she did what she had to do. Did she go so far as to really praise Obama for any reason other than the fact that we have to unite she had to unite the Democratic Party and that the Democratic Party should support him and he's better than the Bush Republicans? Not really, I felt, but I thought it was good enough. It was late, and it was certainly gracious and a real step in the right direction, and probably shut down a lot of the criticism of what she had done on Tuesday. So that, in that sense, it was successful.
Right. You have this, and I hadn't even thought about this. What if this would actually happen? A ticket uniting McCain and Clinton might actually be a better fit than the Obama-Clinton dream ticket, despite their differences on the issues. Well, there we go.
It's not going to happen, but you know, my point there was, beyond all the differences about race, gender, ideology, class, there really is a different point of view between the Obama kind of optimism, and while he's definitely a liberal, his sort of sanded down partisan edges, and the kind of Washington speak of both McCain and Clinton. They both spent a lot of time in Washington. Obama has not, and I think it's those blinders that do contribute to governmental dysfunction and were so in evidence, as I mentioned before, in just the way they handled Tuesday night. They seem to be much more on the same page culturally in terms of how they view government, how they view Washington, and also the whole hierarchy of the presidency. And Obama seems to be on quite a different page.
Frank Rich is our guest, and we are taking phone calls for him right now, as a matter of fact. Columnist for the New York Times, talking about yesterday's column and, of course, the race now between Obama and McCain. His column, One Historic Night, Two Americas. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Call in early. He's with us for just about 10 more minutes, and then Scott McClellan will join us, former White House press secretary, author of What Happened Inside the Bush White House and Washington's Culture of Deception. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Frank Rich, our guest. We start our phone calls with Jim from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
The theme that I want to work today is a combination of propaganda and racism, and I'll just lead into this in a quick oblique path and then get into the racism. I heard a call on another show where a person was talking about regulation of rummage sales, and he called it that it was communism. And it just occurs to me how people are propagandized because they don't they're taught not to question, not to think, just accept what the people in authority tell you, and so people are manipulated as a result of this, and this allows me then to segue to the racism issue, which was a very subtle thing. That when candidates go around, or politicians travel around the world, they'll put on a dog and pony show for the country that they go to and wear the national costume. And Bush has done this, and Obama did it when he went to Kenya. And there was a picture released by another campaign during the primary season, and it was released without comment, but it just showed Obama in native garb of Kenya, which included a turban. Now, what they were trying to do in this propaganda is to very subtly indicate, well, this garb is different from ours. It's strange. And that turban, he might be a Muslim. And the whole inference was that Obama was not one of us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I just want to make people aware of how subtly and insidiously they're propagandized.
Well, I would make one point. Scott McClellan coming on next. You've got the expert to talk about propaganda. Yes, that was an ugly incident, and we'll see more of it. The interesting thing to me is that for all these attempts and some of them were by the Clinton campaign. There's no way around it, to sort of portray Obama as the black candidate or somehow alien. The use of his middle name, of course, all the email rumors, out-and-out falsehoods about his religion. It still didn't quite work. Now, we're talking about a Democratic primary system, but even now, Obama continues to be ahead, however slightly so far, in the polls against McCain. And you have to wonder if, while the this is beginning to fade, this use of racial propaganda. There will always be racists. There will always be racists in America. I'm increasingly wondering whether there really are enough of them to make a huge difference in this election, and whether many of them would never vote for a Democrat anyway, no matter what the race of the Democrat or gender. We'll see. But yes, there are these. There'll be more of this. Although right now, the McCain campaign has been so incompetent about its own imagery. It witnessed the embarrassing performance Tuesday night with that halting speech before.
Yes, and that weird smile that you mentioned, that was weird.
Yeah, it's almost as if someone was taking an electric prod from behind.
Oh, my gosh.
And that green backdrop.
Ooh.
So right now, they can't even control his imagery. It doesn't mean there won't be lots of people out there helping him to try to do stuff with Obama. We'll see. But yes, of course, the public should be aware of it.
Right. Talk more about, I'm not sure how this plays out. I was just struck by all the newspaper headlines from around the world when Obama got the nomination. It seems to me as though he does present this dramatically different vision of America to the world, Frank.
He does. And there's a fascinating story in a paper this morning, not the Times, I think it's the Wall Street Journal, about polling abroad, which I didn't even know they did for American presidential campaigns. And essentially, it's the polls of Europe. This is in Europe, I believe, almost entirely in Europe. But they have a country-by-country breakdown. But overall, it's 52% Obama, 15% McCain.
Oh, my gosh.
And this is not Americans. These are Europeans. And the point of the piece, as I recall it, is that Bush is making his farewell trip to Europe this week. No one seems to care. They don't even expect there to be many protests because he's such a lame duck and he's held in such contempt in most of Europe. And there is this palpable excitement about Obama. I think just he represents something so new and cosmopolitan. Furthermore, they quoted a couple of people in various countries saying, you know, he, after 7 years of a president who, to many Europeans, didn't seem to know what he was talking about, this is a guy who actually seems like he knows what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And one point I made in my column, you know, all this the breastfeeding by the McCain campaign that Obama should go to Iraq. Well, fine, let him go to Iraq, but be fascinating to see what would happen if he visited London, Paris, Berlin,
yes,
whatever on the
yes.
way, because I think it would be a JFK moment, possibly.
Yeah, I think you're right. Email from Jennifer from Chippewa Falls. I'm a 47-year-old woman and have a MySpace page. He's on my friends list, Obama. I never contributed to a political campaign before, but did this year through his MySpace page. He also puts up bulletins, encouraged his supporters to write a letter of thanks to Hillary after she conceded to him. Very smart, very cool.
Well, that I had read about that he encouraged his supporters to write to Hillary Clinton. Maybe some of them even were generous enough to help pay off some of her campaign debt. He has his flaws. Heaven knows they all do. But he does have a sort of graciousness gene that we don't see that often in politics. But the fact that your emailer essentially did this whole transaction through Facebook tells us a lot about a whole different style of campaign.
Exactly.
And not just for young people. She said she's 47, not 17.
Right. Well, you used a couple words. Cocky, I think, was one of them, and preening that he may have a tendency to do. Is this going to harm him? Does he preen too much? How does he preen?
Well, I felt there were times in the campaign where he just exuded being a bit full of himself, and there were times when I felt, standing on the outside, it led him to coast, that it became a little bit too routine, the speeches became stale. Presumably he's learned from it. One thing this campaign has been good at is learning from mistakes, for the most part, when they made him. But, you know, it's got to go to his head. This is a 46-year-old guy at the top of the world, completely improbable, given his background.
Yes, it is.
Race. And so he has some real gifts, and he's just got to not fall in love with them as much as some people around him are, and get out of the bubble. They've all got to try. Every candidate has to try somehow to break through the bubble, and it's hard in this world.
Yeah. One more phone call, and let's go to Patty from Belleville. Hi, Patty.
Hi. Hi, Frank Rich.
Hi.
I am an avid reader of your column.
Thank you.
And my question for you is in regard to news and reporting,
mm-hmm.
and that is, why should we as American citizens, as readers of newspapers like the New York Times, why should we believe in what the U.S. media has to tell us when so many journalists are tied to both corporate money and what seems to be an inability to present us with the truth and factual reporting?
Well, first of all, it's very, very hard to generalize, and no one should use just one news source. The New York Times is actually still mainly a family-run business. It's one of two major newspapers left like that now that Murdoch's bought the Journal, the other being the Washington Post. And so there really is a serious effort in independent reporting. Do we make mistakes? Have we made famous mistakes? Absolutely. We've had, since some of the big ones, we've had more and more transparency and public accounting for our errors. You have to have information, you know, to make decisions as a citizen. Very few people, including the TV networks, are now spending money, for instance, to cover Iraq, which costs millions mm-hmm. of dollars, if only for the security of the reporters who are risking their lives over there. We can't, if you don't have independent news sources, are we going to rely on the Pentagon and the Bush administration or the next administration for all our news about Iraq? And it can't just be people with opinions, too. It's got to be people on the ground supported by news organizations. But whether you read the New York Times or listen to NPR, or watch the BBC, or read any of a number of terrific periodicals, magazines, other newspapers, always compare. Americans have to do the same kind of cross-checking about news that they do when they're buying a toaster oven or a car. Too often, people are passive about it, and that's the real problem.
Yeah.
But there's so many sources available at your fingertips now, whether it be through cable TV or the internet, let alone print, it's crazy not to vet things against each other. I do that myself as a news consumer.
Frank Rich, thank you so much for being with us. It's always
thank
a great
you. It was
pleasure.
Great talking to you as always.
Yeah, thank you. Frank Rich, our guest this first half hour, And we were talking specifically about his column yesterday that looked at Obama's victory in the Democratic primary and looked at Hillary Clinton and John McCain and what it all means to the U.S. and to the world.